we are back with episode 773 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Yeah, this is Gary from Jacksonville, waiting to talk about a whole bunch of new stuff.
That's right. We still have a few nice big juicy topics to get into this week, at least some discussion points, if we will. And then we have some news items that we just want to quickly cover, and then we'll see if and when we get into the episodic discussion. It may be this time, it may be next time, we'll see. But we're still feeling this out as far as we are doing our modifications to our show and our format, so hopefully you guys are enjoying it. Obviously, as we get into deeper discussions, what we're hoping is that we will get some feedback from everyone. So please, everybody, let us know what your thoughts are as you continue to experience these changes as we are rolling them out. And let us know if you agree, disagree, you have different angles on a topic that we haven't considered. Because, some of these are definitely things that we would like to revisit once we get some of your feedback out there. So, before we get into any further discussion, Gary, maybe just a general disclaimer about any news stuff that might come up, because we are probably going to talk about things that could spoil people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as is our tradition, we'd like to warn everybody. We give everyone about a week's time to watch the different shows or some of the news topics that we bring up and go into discussions about. So we're hoping you've had the chance to look at them. If not, we don't apologize, but we just want to make you aware that as part of our discussions, we are going to spoil different things. We will talk about people who live, people who die, twists, turns, and other story aspects that you might not be ready to hear if you haven't watched the show. So if you don't want to watch it or listen to us right now, put us on pause, watch the show, come on back. Or if you'd like us to actually go ahead and spoil it for you, we'll be more than happy to oblige. So just a little heads up that we really don't hold back in any of our discussions or conversations. We want to get into the meat of the story, and that often involves some of the aforementioned spoilers.
Exactly. All right, so what we're going to get into next is some news that I think actually, Gary, you added to our list, which is an update to an ongoing saga.
Well,
I'm going to go ahead and let you take the reins on this one.
Sure, and I'll try not to get too technical about it. And gosh knows
I'll jump in if I have any questions myself.
Okay, fair enough. And we've talked about this a bunch of times because it is honestly a pet project of mine, and I'm really interested in the topic. It's recently been announced that the ongoing lawsuit against Axanar, the Star Trek crowdfunded film, has been settled without going to trial. Trial was set to begin at the end of January, and both parties have agreed to terms going forward that has made the case unnecessary at this point. So it has finally ended. It's been going on now for over 1 year at this point. About 13 months, actually. It was originally filed in December of 2015, right after Christmas. So it's been going on for some time. And just as a general precursor, a guy, Alec Peters, with a bunch of friends, including reasonable names like Gary Graham and Richard Hatch, wanted to do a really good Star Trek fan film. They said, the technology's there. They had enough people and talent, and they wanted to do it. They wanted to put together, get funded through typical crowdfunding, whether it was Indiegogo or Kickstarter, to do this. And some other projects have funded similar projects that way, so they felt that they were doing everything fine. As everyone's well aware, Star Trek has been doing fan films for the past 20 to 30 years, and other than it's pretty much not issuing DVDs and charging for them, Paramount and Viacom and CBS and some of the other companies that have owned the intellectual rights to Star Trek really haven't cared one way or the other. Well, Axanar broke that mold a little bit. They wanted to make one heck of a fan film. They raised over $1 million to do so. They were hiring professional actors. They were hiring professional special effects people to help them put this together. Now, they weren't actually – they argue, and I could somewhat agree, that they weren't profiting per se, but you have to pay some – but you have to pay someone for their time. Not everything's going to always be volunteer if you want high quality. And much as the Red Cross pays all their staff a wage because they're investing their time into it, regardless of how good the cause is, people will still get paid and still considered a nonprofit. So,
one of the points that has been made again and again is that while there are plenty of people that apply that logic to what's going on and haven't been challenged on it, what is a bit in dispute here is the extent to which those funds were then used for not just the project, but potentially other things. So it was becoming less and less about a nonprofit so much as pushing the boundaries a little bit from the point of view of some people.
Oh, I won't disagree with you, John. The idea of renting a studio for over a year's time, building standing sets instead of perhaps borrowing or renting time from some of the other existing Star Trek productions that have standing old series sets. Those are definitely valid things. However, they and I agree. I think even they might agree that they might have stretched the bounds, but they felt for the quality production they wanted to do, the idea to rent space to film for months on end, someone else's space that you couldn't adjust the sets necessarily as you want it, compromise some of the creative directions that they were going. And they felt in the long run to do what originally was planned at somewhere around a 2-hour film, benefited from the freedom of having your own space to film in. Obviously a lot of people disagreed, and I can't say that they're wrong, but those were the reasons that they gave at the time. And I didn't think they were ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think that I don't want to say necessarily that they were incorrect. I don't know that they were one way or the other. What I do know is that there are other fan-funded operations that do similar things, at least in terms of renting space and everything else. But the way in which they did so never rose to the level of attention that people felt the need to start auditing every little move that they made. And for better or worse, in this case, there does seem to be, on a number of levels, as we've explained even last week, where things that would normally just pass without comment have been raised as major transgressions.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And it there are other operations that are in productions, fan productions right now as we speak, that are not only violating the rules that CBS set, but they're doing a lot of these things at the same time that they're doing that.
Oh yeah, they're selling DVDs at conventions. They're using the Star Trek name all over the place. And yeah, it's the $1 million. I have no doubt that sort of raised everyone's flag. Some of the other productions that you mentioned easily cross $150,000 when everything's said and done with their productions. So it's not that they're small potatoes, or do they meet the now $50,000 guideline that's been set forth by CBS. They well exceed that, with every episode. So it's just, I think it was the panache of the 1 million that really sort of raised everyone's sort of attention.
I believe that would be the case. Certainly in terms of the attention from the studio.
Yeah, and
I agree with you. I believe that the actual content of the production itself was part of the issue as well. That it was stepping on ground that inadvertently, or perhaps CBS retroactively decided was going to be the ground that they were going to play in. It doesn't really matter. Cause and effect almost doesn't matter anymore. It's all just...
Well, I'm not quite ready to open that jar or that mess. But basically, you're right. When the movie would be done shooting, they were left with a substantial amount of hard goods, so to speak. They had a studio, they had standing sets, they had lighting, they had a whole bunch of assets at the end of this production that weren't sort of reabsorbed back in. So yes, so there were tangible leftovers after this. Although I'd like to point out that originally they had only asked for like $500,000 to $600,000, so which was maybe about a three times the level of a regular production. But it was the fans that wanted this type of Star Trek so bad that caused them to break and literally triple, in most cases, every request for donations or funding through Kickstarter. Fans more than doubled every time that they asked for something. And so I think it took them, the people from Axanar, a little off guard too, and realized how much people did want something like this, and that CBS and Paramount were not providing it to them in the current versions. So this wasn't somebody ponying up $1 million of their own money trying to make this show. This was tens of thousands of people donating $10, $20, $50, maybe the price of a good movie ticket donations, because they wanted to see this. So as much as people like to fault the Axanar people, don't forget there's a lot of fans that wanted exactly this project.
Yes.
And I think that sometimes gets a little lost as the blame is getting put back and forth. And, as I've always said, for my donation, all I was promised was, I was promised like a 2-hour film that was supposed to be pretty good. And that's all I wanted. If there was a studio left over, if there was a car left over, if there was a spaceship left over, I really, it didn't matter to me. What I was supposed to be promised for my money was the film. And that's all I wanted. So, the fans really never cared. It was just the studios that did. So it's sort of frustrating, and I guess I'm straying a little bit. But let me pull a hard left back into the story quick before I go and get off my soapbox. Anyway, there has been a decision made. They both stopped their lawsuits. There's a few benefits and disadvantages that have happened as a result of this compromise. And as I always like to say, in a compromise, it means everyone loses a little bit. What Paramount and CBS have given up is they're no longer suing Axanar, and that is no small feat. Alec Peters, as well as some of the other people involved, could have been on the hook for up to $100 million due to the way that copyright law is. Every time that they were found to have stolen something from Star Trek, they could have been fined $150,000 per item. Now, whether that would have been the left and the right Vulcaneers, I can't say. But regardless, it could have ended up at over $100 million. So that's gone away. So that's not going to happen. And so that's been lost. Axanar, on the other hand, has had to sort of take a bitter pill at the same time as well. They've given up the idea that Star Trek is fair use. They've been allowed to continue to show their prequel, the Prelude to Axanar, that will continue to be able to air free of charge on YouTube and any place else that does not charge for it without being impeded or changed in any way. But however, going forward for what you would call the Axanar film, they are now required to fall under the guidelines set forth by CBS. So that means 2 15-minute segments. I've heard there's been a little bit of leeway with the with actors who have worked in other Star Trek features before. There was that clause in their thing that they basically said whoever makes a fan film could never, ever have been involved in Star Trek in any other way. They for this particular production, they've relaxed that. So people like Gary Graham, who played Saval on Enterprise, will be able to do that role once more in this episode. I believe some of the background, one or two of the background people as well, has been cleared to participate in the film. And so it's going to be a very different film than that 2-hour movie everyone was promised at the beginning. But at this point, I don't see how we could get much better. CBS refused to budge in their guidelines, which I still feel kills all fan films for Star Trek, or at least in any notable ones. So this is what we end up. We end up with 2 15-minute segments. I'm not sure what's going to happen with the money limitation. It's supposed to be $50,000, but gosh knows, I know they probably spent more than that in the set already. So that I'll have to see. Supposedly they're reworking the script at this point to accommodate that. And I listened to one of the Axanar podcasts that are out there with some of the creative talent, and I think they sort of knew where that it was going to that anyway, and they have been working on it. So I'm hoping production will actually begin within a few months for Axanar, and it's a 30-minute, I guess, total segment. So so it's ended. I think fandom in general is sort of let down, depressed, sad to see really fan films now gone. And I don't think anybody won. I think CBS looks like a bad guy and a bully, and Axanar looks like someone who wasn't able to follow through with originally what they wanted to do. And like I said, no one wins, except I think the fan loses, and that's all that's really happening. I'll just give a sentence or two to say that CBS's new series seems to generously have many things in common with the Axanar concept. And it's as they have announced that they're now bringing in a Vulcan character is as Sarek, yep. Spock's father. It really kind of echoes the Saval character for me in a lot of ways. So it's sort of interesting how much they're borrowing as far as time frames. And now to hear that they're pulling in a historic character from the series to bring in a Vulcan. It just echoes a lot of Axanar. And so if I was Axanar, the best I could say is you inspired CBS in your vision, and maybe CBS will be able to do with it what they wouldn't let you do with it.
Yeah, I think that I'm impressed by the fact that they're even being given the right or the permission to do anything at all. Especially if, as we speculate, the same narrative ground is going to be covered. They probably got about as good as they were going to get out of this whole process. the XNR folks.
Yes. So. Yes, I agree. I don't think there was much more they could have gotten. And even within the guidelines that, geez, everybody hates and, you know, feels kills the fan films, they did give them, you know, a few caveats. I think the budget obviously is still enhanced, as well as being able to use Star Trek actors. And you know, one thing, when they came up with these, I don't think they honestly knew what the hell they were doing either. And they have often said that it was that they considered them guidelines. So maybe there's some flexibility within them going forward as they as this production rolls out. Perhaps they'll relax or allow different things to happen.
It's possible because, I mean, we know that there are always, you know, certain eras in terms of who's running the show for ancillary material and stuff that's non-canonical, as one could say. And there was even the period of time where in the 80s with the pocket books, I remember that if you were writing a Star Trek novel, initially there were a few years where there was just an incredible amount of creativity being applied. And then all of a sudden, for a good 5-10 years, you could not write a novel in that line without it being the most watered down, meaningless stuff, because you couldn't do this laundry list of things that basically was what made the novels great in the first place. And everybody bemoaned it was the end of the, you know, of the novel line. No one was going to, you know, ever be able to do it. And now look at where we are. We've had a huge long period of many different, you know, people in charge, editors in charge. Yes, there's been some ebb and flow, but by and large, I think that they've really unleashed the authors to do a lot of things that normally would never have been permitted during that one period when, you know, Roddenberry was almost pretty much on his last legs. And yeah, it's always possible that 5-10 years from now we're going to see a completely different interpretation. But at the same time, I feel like the reason why that interpretation was so harsh in the first place was because they didn't feel like they could budge too much while this whole suit was being dealt with. Now that that's gone, in the next couple of years, that guideline may loosen more. It's possible.
Yeah, I think it will. And not, you know, not only that, but you know, as production quality continues to go up, as pricing goes down, you know, that $50,000 might go a lot further in 2 or 3 years than it did a year or two ago. So we'll have to see that as well. And my biggest caveat would be the time length that they'd let enough more of a story unfold rather than 2 15-minute segments. So that's probably my biggest hope. The actors relaxing, the issue of anyone who ever worked with Trek again ever be allowed on it. I wouldn't mind that, but I'd say if I had to pick one item, it would be the time limit. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think we mentioned before that there are still productions out there that are challenging that.
Yes,
and they haven't
been
called on it, so that may be a positive sign.
Well, I've always said this was an XNR witch hunt, so
That's I'm kind of dancing around the fact that that's exactly what I'm getting at, is that I feel like now that the XNR thing has been essentially resolved, and they've been hemmed in, and kind of slapped across the nose with a newspaper, so to speak. Now, do they really feel like having to enforce these rules so tightly? I don't think they have the same impetus to do so.
No, I agree.
They've got a lot of other things that they need to worry about. Like getting their show off the ground, because the whole irony of this is that the show should have been out by now. And that was the first date, then they said May, and now it is not even a disclosed time frame.
No, yet supposedly production started, I guess, at this point.
Well, yeah, they've got most of the cast ready to go. But I'm guessing that they're still tweaking things after more or less running Brian Fuller out of the writer's room. And whether or not they are retooling completely or just still trying to get their footing, I don't know. But now the show is, while in production, they are not putting a time frame on when it will actually come out. So, interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear them back off once again with the release date. And I almost, you know, as much as we want to list it as show problems, I wonder how much of the whole format is involved too. Maybe there are issues with the with this whole direct to digital concept that they're having issues with as well.
It may be because it's not going to be the first show that they're putting out that's kind of high profile. The follow up to The Good Wife is coming out soon.
Yes.
And I'm really interested in seeing how they handle that, because Star Trek is, for better or worse, still, to a degree, perceived as a niche market.
Yes, a marginal product, yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
The Good Wife and a potential sequel to it, not so much. So no, on the one hand, while that does give promise to the fact that, oh, they're not just doing this with Star Trek, and then if it's disposable, so to speak, they are putting some high-profile things out there.
I'm curious with the Good Wife spinoff to see, production quality and things of that nature, as it's, I imagine it's going to be the model that they follow for Star Trek to some extent. So I'm curious to see how much they're willing to invest after Fuller basically blasted them for doing it too cheap.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So if people notice or feel like the spinoff for The Good Wife, it looks like it's being done on the cheap, that's going to be a very bad commentary.
And can they do it for under $1 million an episode the way that Axon was going to?
Nice parting shot.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah.
All right, we'll go ahead and leave this until if we hear any more news, because this should be the end of the story, but you never know. Stories sometimes have spinoffs. We are going to take our mid-show break, and then when we come back, we're going to delve into yet another topic, and we'll see how long we talk about that one before we get into other news items, but we'll be right back. Okay, so we are back, and we have another topic. As I said, the list of news items was kind of small this week, so not a whole lot to talk about here. But one of the things that it's not on the list here, Gary. Sorry, but
no problem.
One of the things that I noticed as I was talking with some folks, or at least reading some of their commentary, was, you know, we are looking at the return of the DCW shows in the next couple weeks. In fact, once this episode is out, it should already be underway. And there were a couple people that were rewatching the 4-show crossover, 3.1 show crossover. and then others that were commenting on the changes to the DCW as a whole over the last couple of years, and how it's changed their feelings about, say, Arrow, because, you know, Arrow, of course, being the flagship, so to speak. And so what it was kind of coming down to is that there were some people that were starting to feel like, is the DCW almost oversaturated at this point? Just in general, your thoughts upon me saying something like that, you know, or that statement, is your gut reaction to agree, disagree? Where do you stand on that?
Well, I mean, we're just coming off the back of this, the four-show crossover. So I can definitely see how people might have that taste about them, but I don't know. I feel definitely that Legends of Tomorrow has muddied those waters by crisscrossing over so much. It feels with Arrow. I wish they did stand on their own a little bit more. I don't think that any one show hinges on the other, especially Supergirl. They haven't, to a large extent, integrated her at all. Arrow and Flash have played off each other, but, you know, given that Flash spurred from Arrow, it always seems natural when things interact. So I don't quite have that issue. Legends of Tomorrow seems a little painful when they cross over with, especially with Arrow. I always sort of wince a little bit to see what they're going to do to Ollie this time. when they cross over with it. So I can't say that part of that isn't actually there. Is it super oversaturated? No, but I really don't want them crossing over often. And they need to do it less so that it becomes something special. Now, like I said, you know, with Arrow and Flash, I don't mind Barry, you know, swinging over to have a coffee with Oliver or something like that. But when you have like the Legends of Tomorrow pull Supergirl over, geez, it's awful clunky, and it's obvious it's clunky because it just doesn't work. I mean, comic books have the same problem when they try to do these, you know,
that's true, yeah,
whole thing crossover. It's rare that you can have, you know, two different characters who come from two different environments and are used to fighting a certain class of villain all of a sudden cross over and basically have to go out of their comfort level, either up or down. It's often clunky. Comic book writers, I remember they said the worst book I've ever had to write is a Batman Superman book because, you know, they're two different levels of heroes and there's really no crossover. You either have to, you know, power Superman down or make Batman unbelievably strong. And it's always a pain. And that's sort of what you run into, I think, with this show.
Well, you know, I hear what you're saying and I completely agree. And that is where I feel like we gave them a lot of benefit of the doubt, if you will, when they started announcing all of these cast members that were going to be shared between all four shows potentially. They weren't show guests, you know, they weren't being contracted to be on one show. They were contracted to be in the, you know, franchise, in the sub-network even. What occurs to me is that what the CW is asking, what the DCW is asking is, guys, in any given week, half a network's output is going to be what we expect you to keep up with. Because it is like, okay, if you want to have all the pieces to the overall universal story, you have got to watch all of this stuff. Because potentially something could happen on Supergirl that 3 weeks from now could mean something on The Flash. And so, yeah, you're being asked to, you know, and it's not unlike you said, where the comic book universes do this all the time, and it becomes very difficult, especially on a budget, to keep up with everything. But this is a network, this is TV, so this is saying, like, you know, whether it be 3 nights a week, 4 nights a week, whatever it may be, and with Legends of Tomorrow moving onto the same night as The Flash, boy, that, thanks guys, needed that. because that's also the same night as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., so it's competing shows now, or a three-hour block of comic book adaptations, which, okay, but it kind of gets to my point. It's really a time investment. It's basically saying, we want you to spend all your time in our universe, which, from a network point of view, of course they do. They want you to have eyeballs on their content. But it is a huge investment, and it also does strain the... constrain the writers, however you want to put it, both, because now they've got to try and figure out how these things work. And I think there are fans of Arrow that are, you know, rightfully saying, was this a good thing? Now that it's been a couple of years, Arrow is doing pretty well, having its own sense of identity. But the more that you expand the DCW, the more these shows start losing their identity. And I think this year we've seen that happen a few times. And we kind of compared, contrasted during the crossover episodes, and it was a huge thing. No one has ever done anything like that before. But you know, they are saying, of course, next year they want to do it again, and everyone's really excited about it. I just think, are they biting off more than they can chew, or are they asking the audience to bite off too much?
Oh, I think they're asking the audience to bite off too much. They need to maybe do two shows, but doing all four is it just doesn't work. I mean, Supergirl was clumsily shoehorned in. Some of it didn't even seem to work. The Flash is zipping around at super speed, laying mental bombs on all the aliens, and you have Ollie's guys sort of going hand to hand with some people. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work well for me. I enjoyed it, but at the same time, there were tons of flaws, and I don't think it's something they need to do. You know, much as we were talking in the previous episode about, you know, translating comic books to TV shows, I think this is sort of running into the same problem. They're like, oh, this works for TV shows. Let's do it. I mean, for comic books, let's do it on the TV. And it's cute as a little novel kind of thing, a wink or a nod. But to actually construct construct so much around it seems to be a mistake for me. I don't think many of the TV viewers necessarily want that level. It's not just a name check with the people. You know, they still want good story, and the story was kind of weak.
It was. Crossover stories tend to be pretty challenged in general.
However, it's that balancing of characters. It's hard to balance an Arrow versus a Supergirl.
Yes. And I think that it's actually hurting, to your point about Batman-Superman, it's practically the same thing, right?
It hurts
Arrow more than it does Supergirl. Because Supergirl, clearly they brought her in. She was kind of shoehorned in to a certain extent, as many people felt. But she goes back to her world, and it's like nothing happened. But now the Arrow world has to deal with the fact that this exists.
The president's dead, all sorts of stuff.
Their world is now the one that has to deal with this, and you've taken it that much further away from the world where there's just a bunch of guys with weapons and talents, and it's not nearly the same show that it used to be. And I understand shows need to evolve, and I certainly have been a champion of the positive side of these things. I don't want it to sound like it's nothing but negativity. But I do feel like, as we look into the future, I say to myself, if we're sitting here and saying to ourselves, you know, we want to pick and choose a little bit what shows we choose to follow, in a sense, if you want to follow any one of the DCW shows, you're almost obligated right now to follow all four. And yeah, that's asking an awful lot of the audience. And now I can see why, you know, people are a little leery of it, because if you wanted to watch Arrow before, you could watch Arrow and binge watch it and you wouldn't miss a thing. Could you say that about any of the four shows? That maybe Supergirl this year, but the other three shows?
No.
Like, can you imagine binge watching them? It'd be confusing. There's so many things that they're cross-referring to. It reminds me of a little bit that if you go back and you try and binge watch like Buffy and Angel right now, there are those occasional moments where they did cross over and you were expected to see both episodes and then they refer to stuff. And it is a little jarring.
Yeah.
All four DCW shows are doing that right now. As I said, Supergirl probably the one that is the least affected. But there are those moments where you're watching the show and it's clearly setting something else up.
Well, what was it when they had the Flash thing to mention to Diggle that he's got a daughter now where he had a son?
Right.
Why the hell did that even have to happen? What's the point of linking that? I don't get it.
No, it's like them dropping Flashpoint, and it was like, if you do this for real, you've just infected all three of those shows with this one plot device. Arrow has no choice but to deal with this in some way, shape, or form. They found a way that was, at least right now, seems fairly innocuous. But no, it isn't one show anymore. You can't just say, I'm going to be a fan of The Flash and just watch The Flash. There's too much else that happens that you're supposed to know about.
Well, do you think the solution is to have it all on one night?
Oh, God. I can just imagine everybody getting exhausted by that. I think that it's more that I hope they don't continue to expand. That's for sure.
Well, they are going to expand, aren't they, John?
I don't think they are.
However, I've heard that it's not going to be a universe thing. Isn't that what...
Yeah, there's another show that the producers are making, but it is on another network and it is not going to cross over.
Okay. That's what they said, I think. Yes, that's what they said about Supergirl, though.
Well, Supergirl was always pitched to be CW, and then it was courted by CBS to try and get in on it, so to speak. Here I think it is going in with the knowledge of we don't want to have that happen again. At least the way they are they're kind of speaking to it. How honest they're being, we'll see. But unless they're going to make basically the CW just the DCW channel, which, you know, I'm sure they're tempted. I would feel like what they kind of need to do is either limit what they're doing to a certain degree or really think about maybe keeping one or two of them in their own little sandbox. I don't know that there's an easy way out now that you've opened the door, right? Can you go back?
Yeah.
I don't know that you can.
For example, the Legends of Tomorrow could disappear into time pretty easy, and that'd be gone. Supergirl still is in a different universe, technically. So, you know, it wouldn't be hard to seal that off. I mean, they could go back, but like you said, is it ratings? Is this what people want to see? And maybe I don't see it or you don't see it, but... I think the crossover, while cute, was not something that I need to see in that kind of format again. So,
oh, it killed in the ratings. That's the thing, is that it was a novelty. But now the question is, is there a huge amount of excitement to see it again? I don't know. Yeah, you could do that. I think that what they did last year actually worked out better, which is that they didn't put out Legends of Tomorrow until kind of like counter to when the other shows were running, or as a self-contained show that was in the universe, but it wasn't constantly crossing over with the other shows. You could find that happy medium. The thing is that once you take that away, I think I agree with you, the reason for that show to exist, it's extraneous.
Yeah. Or maybe, John, you know, maybe it's us. Maybe it's the maybe what if they weren't all airing identically? You know, as we, you know, well, we don't really mention it as this term anymore, but it still really does exist. You know, as you have summer shows.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if it was staggered where you weren't getting, like, as you said, 4 full hours a week of the universe, maybe that might cause a difference.
I think that actually would help a lot. I think that if they were to do, and that was actually one of the things that was coming to mind, is like, go ahead, throw it on in the summer. You wanted to have, a 12-month cycle anyway. We no longer have traditional seasons in the sense that they used to exist. So go ahead, throw it in there. I think that actually that would work out great because there is still a pretty big dip in the amount of quality stuff out there in the summer. Throw it on then. I think that people would embrace that. It would definitely help to eliminate this feeling of, well, I missed a couple weeks. Forget it. I'm already lost. I'm already behind. But as I said, I don't know if there's an easy solution because now they have set this up and now it's almost like they feel like they have to live with it. That's the sense that I get. Plus, quite frankly, I don't know that they see it as a problem, as you said, because they're so excited about it. They love it so much.
Yeah.
So, I guess we'll find out because certainly we'll hear in just a few months about what the fall schedule looks like. I wouldn't mind if they were to do it that way. Like, for instance, I am perfectly happy with... Instead of, like, last couple years, The Vampire Diaries and The Originals running at the same time, I actually felt like that was too much. I like what they're doing this year. Run one season, then run the other one. So you get, you get two seasons, but you get them staggered. And you still have a piece of that universe on at some point during the schedule. You know, if I had the same advice for ABC, okay, you want to have an Inhumans show. Don't put it on... at the same time as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. wait and take Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. if you still have it on the air next year, which I think is a big if. If you still have it next year, delay it until after Inhumans is done. Then put Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on. Just like you used to do, where it was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., first half of the season, then Agent Carter, then second half of the season. I think it would work out well that way. But we'll find out what their intentions are in the fullness of time. For right now, we are pretty much getting to the point where we are ready to wrap this episode up. Any of these news items here, Gary, kind of jump out at you for some real quick overviews? For instance, for me, I am excited about the Good Omens TV miniseries that Amazon is supposed to be putting out next year. That has caught my attention. How about you?
Nothing really jumps. I think we've talked about the ones that jumped out this week. I didn't know if we wanted to handle the In Memoriam section quickly. I don't know how much time
we have a little bit of time, and it probably isn't something that we want to dwell too much upon, other than the fact that, yeah, we've been talking about Twin Peaks quite a lot, and unfortunately, we did have a loss from the Twin Peaks family this week. Miguel Ferrer, the actor who played Albert Rosenfield in the original run and did film all of his parts in the new season that will be coming out in just a couple of months. He unfortunately passed at the age of 61 from cancer. So he had been ill for some time, but even those who knew him fairly well and were kind of keeping track of what his progress was were fairly stunned that it happened so quickly. So unfortunately, yeah, that happened just literally a few days after it was finally announced when the return of Twin Peaks was going to happen, and he had been scheduled to be at that press conference, but he unfortunately missed it because of his illness. So, as I said, a little bit unfortunate that it happened so soon, and he wasn't able to be around for the reception of his latest work. And, of course, he was in many other shows. I don't have the article open right now.
Well, the two notable ones for me would be RoboCop. He was in. He's been around film for a long time. The original RoboCop, and as well as a nice bit part in Star Trek III: Search for Spock. He was on the USS Grissom before it blew up. So he got to touch that. And as a Star Trek fan, you know, he had mentioned the fact that Leonard Nimoy directing him while he's in the Star Trek uniform on a bridge of a starship was a dream come true for him as a Star Trek fan. So that was a nice little quote from him. He was also on a bunch of other stuff. He was in Iron Man 3. He had a recurring role on Desperate Housewives for a few years, as well as the Crossing Jordan series. So he's been in theater, but movies and television for a long, long time. Hey, John, and even in your corner of the woods, he did voices for Halo 2, actually. So he's had quite a presence and impact. And as an actor, I always enjoyed watching him work. Even when he played a bad guy, you always wanted to like the character, no matter who he was playing. So I've enjoyed his work. I'll miss seeing him further, but thankfully, as you just said, John, at least we will be seeing some of his work coming up in Twin Peaks, so we get a little bit more of Miguel.
That's right. And certainly all of our sympathies to his family, and we're hoping that this is not a harbinger of 2017 living up to 2016's reputation. So, all right, we'll go ahead and wrap this episode up, and then when we come back next time, we'll be getting into episodic discussion, so stay tuned.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review. So let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.